Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. Again, a reminder, we Zoom on Monday, so if information should happen on Monday night, it will not be part of this conversation on Tuesday. We begin our show every single day with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. It is his impeachment testimony of 2019. We're going to be hearing this every single day between now and November. I want you to remember Colonel Vindman as you go into the voting booth or you get the opportunity to vote by mail. Now, Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free, free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
Joining us, as he does almost every other week, is one of my faves. Robert Henney is at Stuck Nation. He writes for Salon.com. He writes for The Chief Leader. He writes for NJ.com. He is prolific. He has a tremendous knowledge of history. And he sent me a whole series of articles, all of which probably deserve an hour. But Bob, I'm only going to give you 24 minutes.
Thanks.
The first one is interesting because in a lot of ways, it is kind of a parallel to what happened to George Floyd in the sense that it's the murder of a young black man, in this case, much younger than George, by a white cop. But the difference between these two stories is one was on video. So there was 8 minutes and 49 seconds of knowledge of the murder. This one has taken forever to become part of the public conversation. And frankly, it's not even part of the public conversation. And the question is, why so long? Why is everything so secretive? And at a time like this, transparency is demanded.
Well, thanks for having me on. I guess what we have here is an opportunity to look at just what a difference it makes to have something in broad daylight that is videotaped by the public and that then can become part of our conversation. There's a downside and there's an upside. In the upside, in the case of the Floyd matter, it was a civilian, a young woman, I believe, who had the courage to stay on point despite the fact that this was a very violent, traumatic incident and she was being waved off of it. And that was able to go viral because it wasn't the possession of the government.
Right.
In the instant case we're talking about now about Maurice Gordon, who's 28 years old, this was a case where it was far south in the Garden State Parkway in the middle of the night, in the after hours. It was several hours, maybe even 30 hours of interaction with local police and with state troopers. And the only thing that we have to go on is the video that's available from the trooper car and whatever video is part of the trooper's comings and goings and some things at rest stops in terms of, and all of this was in the possession of the Attorney General. And in New Jersey, as of 2019, in what was couched as a reform, the Attorney General is responsible for doing an independent investigation of any time that there is a use of force resulting in the death of the civilian when in the custody of the police. And so this happened on, ironically, May 23rd, 48 hours before Mr. Floyd was killed in police custody. But in that whole period of time, up until just today, we're recording this today, the family of Mr. Gordon didn't know where he died, didn't know if he died on the roadside, which indeed he did, didn't know what the disposition was, how it was he came to be in the trooper car, and even the identity of the trooper. And it was only after a spate of stories that happened, I would say, the Star Ledger, Insider NJ, and several other outlets, the Burlington County Times. But this means this story surfaced. The only stories before that was a terse dispatch, half of a birth announcement on the 23rd of May that basically said a civilian died, it's under investigation, it involves law enforcement, with no mention of the color of the civilian's skin, nor the fact that a state trooper was involved. And then,
or that the state trooper was white.
Right, exactly. And so scroll forward, May 26th, we get the name of the individual who passed, Mr. Gordon, but no frame about the context of it. And so it was really only until the family, Mr. Wagstaff, the attorney representing Mr. Gordon's family, pursued the matter and spent 9 days trying to get more information just recently that this latest round of information, we came up to do this today, there was a core dump of documents and video and all that the Attorney General has been using to conduct an independent investigation. It's instructive also to add that New Jersey has a long tortured history with racial profiling, that in fact, after a shooting that involved three young men, unarmed, by two white state troopers, and years of documented racial profiling, in many cases brought to the attention of authorities by troopers of color who I reported on, who brought this systematic process to the attention of the authorities, New Jersey entered into a federal consent decree for years, and in 2009 got a clean bill of health. So that's
Bob,
what I'm trying
to figure out is that how atypical is it for the New Jersey authorities to wait so long? I mean, this is a cop. He killed someone during the course of duty. We don't know what the issue is. It turns out it's a white cop and it's a black kid.
Right.
But on top of that, we're talking weeks.
Right.
We're talking weeks with no information. This is just, I mean, it doesn't make any sense to go for so long. Because, I mean, if it was anyone else, if it was, you know, Donald Trump's son, or if it was my kid, I would want the information out and public within 24 hours. We are talking weeks, and it's only because of the attorney that the family had to hire, that they had to sort of pull the information out. That's unconscionable.
Well, and it also gets to the anemic nature of the Fourth Estate. One of the things that's happened, we've talked about this before, it's a constant theme of our conversation. We've seen a 45% reduction in local reporters. Back when I was coming up as a reporter, working stories like this, you wouldn't be satisfied if you knew that a trooper was involved in the fatal shooting. You'd be on that story. You'd be going and knocking on doors.
Exactly.
But now, because of how decrepit the state of local journalism is, you wait for the handout, quite frankly. You wait for the Attorney General to frame the conversation. Right. And there's nobody staying on you. There's no editor saying, oh, Henley, when you go by on the way home tonight, go stop by and see what the latest is. There's nobody doing that. So if you don't see the abuse in broad daylight and have the courage of your convictions to document it, and you're going to count on the Fourth Estate and it's the middle of the night at the Garden State Parkway, that's right. Jesus better be your co-driver.
Well, so let me ask a question. And has anyone posed this to the Attorney General? In light of George Floyd, what's the knuckle dragging for? Like, I'm just trying to, if not now, when? If not now, why don't you do something within 24 or 48 hours? I mean, what else do you need? You've got the movie. You've got the backdrop. You've got the protests. You've got the defund the police. I mean, I just can't believe that people could be so damn tone deaf not to recognize that this is not a time to not be forthcoming with information. You shouldn't have it dragged out of you. You should be holding press conferences and explain to the people, this is what we're doing, this is the investigation, this is the tape. I mean, I don't understand New Jersey.
But it also has to do with the fact that the attorney, Mr. Wagstaff, brought this up in the piece in Insider NJ. The state of New Jersey's attorney general has a challenge here, because generally, if it's been a municipal police force, and we have hundreds of them, there would be an appropriate tension, and you could make the colorable claim that it's an independent examination. The attorney general's looking at a municipal police force. Here's what's problematic, is that you have the state of New Jersey state police being investigated by the attorney general, who incidentally and coincidentally will have to defend the state in the event of the guaranteed wrongful death civil procedure.
Oh,
and so you have this, what I believe is an unsustainable contradiction, where you can't have the same entity investigating the state police that's going to prepare the state's defense at civil trial. Wouldn't that, Ken, don't you agree?
Oh,
yeah,
no,
it's all. It's also the same attorney general whose office is going to prosecute, if they're going to, or make the decision whether to prosecute the officer for murder.
That's just what he said. I mean,
right.
But it's
no, he's talking about the wrongful death case, the civil case.
Right.
Oh, the civil case. But there could be a criminal case here.
Yes,
yeah,
could.
There's
right,
both.
Right.
Yeah.
So isn't this must have happened before? There isn't like an ombudsman. There isn't some independent whatever that recognizes that there has to be a line of demarcation because, you know, the appearance of impropriety is potentially there.
No.
And how can you make this arm's length decision when you're going to be have to sort of weigh, well, do I see it? Do I not see it? Do I report it? I mean, this makes no sense.
Well, they insist that it's independent structurally, but I do believe this is part of the national movement for police accountability and to reinvent
right.
The way that we have things like we have this indemnification process where police officers, for the most part, can be guaranteed that unless their activity is clearly criminal, they can be guaranteed that the state, the municipality, or whoever they're operating under as who they're employed by, will defend them in court.
So you just got a big document dump today, so we're not going to know exactly what was in it.
Right.
And unfortunately, I mean, the good news is you're on. The bad news is you haven't had time to go through all
right.
the documents. What I'm again kind of surprised by is that given the moment, delay looks so bizarre. It just feels like, are we learning anything in real time? What does this experience mean? Not for Minnesota, but for everywhere. We're seeing California having conversations about the police. We're seeing New York having conversations about the police. You would think that New Jersey would want to be somewhat sensitive. You have Chris Murphy, who's the governor, who obviously has his concerns now. I'm just trying to figure out how to connect the dots to what happened here and the fact that we're talking weeks.
Right. Well, I think that part of it is that New Jersey has this history that was so problematic. And the fact that all throughout the 1980s and 1990s, troopers of color were coming forward. I was writing about their stories. And for a long time, the state really was in denial. And then after this terrible shooting on the turnpike with these three young men, miraculously, they were grievously wounded, but they all survived. There were two troopers that were criminally tried, but it didn't stick. And so that's been, and so New Jersey wanted so badly to turn the page on this. It spent a fortune on all kinds of body video stuff for the dashboard, all kinds of sensitivity training, all kinds of recruiting. So to think in 2009, oh, they figure like the federal consent decree is in the rearview mirror and here it is again, the same kind of thing. And so the state's response, I think, was to try to get their arms around it and to make sure they all had all their facts. But I think they failed to understand, because remember this happened 48 hours before Floyd happened.
Right.
What the consequence would be and how hard they'd have to work to get the credibility back. I do think that we are seeing this move in Congress and in state legislatures and local governments to change the entire architecture around police accountability.
So,
and they can't put that genie back in the bottle.
They can't. Donald Trump will try. I think he's having a press conference today with the police and basically saying, I'm, you know, the Democrats are crazy and look what they're doing and they want to get rid of the police and who's going to keep you safe but me. I mean, it's going to be very interesting to see. I mean, Donald Trump is obviously playing to his base and playing to the cop unions. I don't know whether people are going to be receptive to it, because one of the things that's been so interesting about the days and days and days of protests, one is the protests have actually gotten more peaceful. They've gotten bigger.
Right.
They've gotten more diverse. I mean, it's been very interesting. It hasn't been a crescendo of anger. It's actually done the opposite.
Well, and I would say there's also a major turning point. We talked about this a little bit over the weekend, but you're seeing major unions, and I've just now got something from the American Federation of Government Employees that represents 700,000 federal workers, support Black Lives Matter in this moment of national moral crisis, their words. You're seeing in New York City, DC 37, one of the largest unions. You're seeing CWA. You're seeing 1190 SEIU, representing millions of workers, actually taking the leadership to task, a political leadership for what they feel is the local police, NYPD, and the way they feel they violently handled the protests.
Yeah.
The idea that, I will tell you that this for labor is the most defining moment since Martin Luther King walked on this earth.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me, because I posted something on Facebook and I said, look, I said this police union in Minnesota is not unlike most police unions around the country. And in fact, I believe the Minnesota AFL-CIO condemned the actions right. of the union president. And in the end, I am the daughter of two union members. My father was a chapter chairman in New York City for his union. And one of the things that my father truly taught me about unions was that it was really important for unions to understand that they needed to embrace accountability and transparency. That if you were truly to protect your union members, you didn't cover up. You made sure that if there was a problem, it was exposed. One, because it wasn't good to cover up impropriety or things that were clearly a mistake, but it actually hurt the union. It didn't help in its integrity. And that's really what I think is going on with these police unions, is that they are not helping their members. They are hurting their members. Well, the level of distrust now is for every cop, and that's not fair. That's not fair. But that's what the unions have done. Instead of being able to sort of have a level of trust with them, you now assume that in some ways, what are they covering up? That's the first question you ask, and that's wrong. Like the first question I want to know, so how many complaints have you had?
Right.
You know, that's a terrible question.
Well, I wanted to just offer a little context here. There's a couple of things operating. One is we are in a situation, we've had a society that's been deteriorating for a long time. We've had all kinds of issues with the deinstitutionalization of mental health, the growth of homelessness, our underinvestment in public health. And we have asked the police to deal with all of it.
Right.
And the things that we don't want to deal with, we want the police to handle. And that has been only growing in the scope and size right. of what's happening. So it's created this culture of inside outside, where, and this transcends color, by the way, you can run into situations where officers of color internalize this sense of us versus them. It's not necessarily race-based, but it's about the power dynamic. You have PBAs, unions that, the people are rising to power because they speak to the unaddressed grievances of the officers. They really don't care what the public thinks. They're only going to win elections by the members feeling that they have the most militant message.
Right.
So right. if it looks like Donald Trump is pro-law enforcement and he's the guy that wants to get it done and he's for taking the handcuffs off the police, then they side with that worldview. And the other problem is, there's been a tension within law enforcement agencies and within all kinds of unions and even law enforcement unions. You have, in general, an increasingly more diverse police presence in America. It really came true in the NYPD over the last several years. And even within the PBA and the other sergeants and lieutenant organizations, there's a challenge for them of how to have succession in terms of leadership. Are they, and so there's a tension even within the PBA to reflect even the ranks, the growing diversity within their ranks. Add to that this fact that so often the PBAs themselves become, New York City had a huge PBA corruption problem where they were involved with just crass corruption of ripping off everybody. Yeah. And so that's all part of it as well. And then also I think that the underlying issue here, particularly in the period of COVID, we're also telling them that they have to do all this frontline work with the risk of bringing home to their families this virus. So we do have to bring some compassion to the overall picture.
But Bob, let me just say something. So I was listening to a doctor on MSNBC this morning, and they were talking about the protesters, and they were talking about the concern people have about another bump in COVID-19 because of social distancing, and a lot of young people still don't wear masks, like somehow they're invincible.
Right.
But for the most part, you saw a lot of mask wearing, and you saw people at least attempt to do some social distancing. One of the doctors on the show said, but you know what was shocking to him? The cops weren't wearing masks.
No, it's true.
So here you have these police who are there to supposedly protect and provide some level of security, but they were being made even more vulnerable because even as they were supposed to keep the situation secure, they were creating a level of insecurity within themselves because they're not wearing masks.
Well, that's not uniform. I have seen a mixture on that. You can't make a universal statement.
No. I'm not saying that. But as what I was hearing, this was about DC, and what I was hearing from this doctor was he was apoplectic because he was so concerned. Well, let me just read you something. Someone just sent me something, and then I need to let you go. But Bob, this is what someone said. When you hear the term defund the police, it's not some anarchistic liberal idea meant to simply stir up controversy or completely abolish cops altogether. He says, look at these images. On the left, a nurse, likely working dozens of hours overtime saving lives while risking her own and possibly her family's, forced to wear a makeshift PPE made from trash bags and tape. On the right, a cop, like so many others we've seen, laden with thousands of dollars worth of gear, maybe a face mask, maybe a mask.
Gas mask,
batons, ammunition. He, probably a union-protected officer, who's meant to protect the citizens he serves, standing alongside so many others prepared for battle at war. When we say defund the police, we mean our nurses need PPEs. We mean our teachers need fair pay. We mean our students deserve quality education, food, and materials. We mean our healthcare should be guaranteed as a human right. Because if we can spend $721 billion on defense and $115 billion per year on police equipment and training, then we sure, as you know what the word is, can afford more than $150 million a year for nursing programs and less than $60 billion a year to educate the entire country. A country full of forgotten, dismissed, and discarded people who are promised simple things like freedom and protection from oppression. This is America. That was the deal. The deal has been broken. That's why we march.
Can I just add one thing, Arnie? When you're reading that piece, how what we mean by defund the police is that police shouldn't have these fancy equipment and everything to protect themselves and leave nurses with no coverage. I think that what people mean by defund the police is really instead of spending millions of dollars for the police not only personally be protected, but to have tanks and these other military equipment, there are a lot of social problems that we send the police to deal with, like
that's
we send them to schools should have social workers.
Right. Exactly.
Social workers in the schools, spend the money on that, not just protective equipment for teachers, but social workers in the schools or drug treatment people instead of sending the police to a drug den, drug rehab work.
I just got to say, though, the military industrial complex is a key part of this conversation. Really didn't like Lafayette Square and Park, and we've been dishing that kind of stuff out for decades in other countries.
And Bob, you sent me an article that you wrote in 2018. I posted it on my Facebook page. Right. I'm going to put it on the Attitudes Facebook page. I want everyone to read it. It's the history of racism in New Jersey. It is an incredible piece. I am so grateful that you sent it to me. And more importantly, what I want people to know is you have to know history as you look forward to making policy today. If you're not honest about the history, you won't comprehend the urgency of the moment, and you won't actually recognize your responsibility in making the change. Robert Hennelly writes for Salon.com. He writes for The Chief Leader. You can find him at Stuck Nation. He writes for NJ.com. His piece about the history of racism in New Jersey is a must read, a must read. And what it forced me to say is, what's my history in New Hampshire? I wonder if someone's going to actually peel the onion and tell us the dirty little secrets that we've never been told. Thank you so much for joining us. Ciao.
Thanks, Bob.
All right, everyone, stick around. Right after the break, we're joined by the great Hedrick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1917. That was the day the Granite Mountain and Speculator Mines in Butte, Montana, caught fire, killing 168 miners. It is considered the worst underground hard rock mining disaster in the nation's history. Just weeks after the U.S. had entered World War I, the demand for copper had surged. Granite Mountain, like many of the nation's mines, operated around the clock to meet war production needs. In his book, Fire and Brimstone, The North Butte Mining Disaster of 1917, Michael Puntke notes the irony of the disaster, which began as an effort to improve safety. A sprinkler system had just been installed. The final task was the relocation of an electrical cable. The cable was insulated with oil-soaked cloth sheathed in lead. Workers lost control of the 3-ton cable as they lowered it into the mine and it fell to the bottom of the shaft. Carrying a commonly used carbide burning lamp, the night shift foreman accidentally ignited the cable as he planned its removal. The conflagration was virtually immediate and burned for more than 3 days. At the time, 415 miners were at work on the overnight shift. Smoke and gases quickly filled both mines. With no alarm system in place, those that could not escape succumbed to carbon monoxide poisoning. In 1996, a memorial plaza was dedicated to those who lost their lives. It details a slice of Butte's mining and labor history that culminated in tragedy.
The suffering and the pain we remember to this day. The miners.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
There's something happening here, but what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop. Children, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. There's battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. Thousand people in the street singing songs and a carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Into your life it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look.
Joining us right now is Hedrick Smith. He is the executive editor of Reclaim the American Dream. Is that correct? I have it right.
Reclaim.org. ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org.
Oh, ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org, because you need to go check it out. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. He's written for the New York Times. He's been on PBS. He's never stopped. That's, as I was looking at your history, Hedrick, what is amazing is that the passion you felt as a young man is a passion that you feel today. And there's a continuum of caring. There's a continuum of publishing. There's a continuum of curiosity to make sure that we have the facts at our fingertips in order to make the best policy decisions we can. So let me publicly say thank you for never stopping.
Okay, well, I'm going to say the same to you. It takes one to see one.
Well, thank
you're
you.
You're the same way, Arnie.
So right now you've done a lot of work focusing on the vote and getting out the vote. And we're looking at this 2020 election because it's probably one of the most pivotal elections in our lives.
No question. And
it's not just because of Donald Trump, although Donald Trump has really seemed to sort of exacerbate the problem, but we are looking at everything from pandemics. We're looking at climate change. We're looking at grotesque inequity. There's just so much on our plate. And so much of it is going to require us to make change. Your most recent piece was about the idea of what Donald Trump is trying to do, which is to undermine our ability to trust the results of 2020. Yeah. So let's really talk about that, because that's Donald Trump's ace in the hole. He really wants to make sure that whatever the result is, he can manipulate how we perceive it.
Yeah, well, the attack that has attracted so much attention is Trump's attack on mail voting. It's fraud, it's cheating, it's impossible. They're going to reprint the ballots that they're going to steal out of the mailboxes. They're going to sign the signatures of dead people. Kids are going to multiply them. They're going to jam the mailboxes and that kind of stuff. You know, and what's really wonderful is that you have Republican governors and Republican secretaries of state, as well as Democrats, saying that not in our state, it's not going on in our state, maybe somewhere else, but not here. I mean, nobody who's running an election in America says we're doing a bad job, right? They don't want to say that. But in addition to that, we've had five states that have for 15 or 20 years now used nothing but mail voting. You can go mail in person in Washington state or Utah or Colorado or Montana, but Hawaii. But, you know, they've been voting. There have been 100 million ballots cast since 2000 in Oregon by mail. Right. And there have been 12 cases they have found that are questionable. Now, that's cleaner than Ivory soap. Remember Ivory soap, 99.44, 100% pure. But voting is so much cleaner than the cleanest of the clean soaps that it's a joke. Okay, so we know that. And not only do we know that, we also know that when Donald Trump wants to count mail votes, he counts them. He votes by mail himself. So does Melania. So does Vice President Pence. So does his wife. Right. A whole lot of people who work in the White House, and a whole lot of wealthy Republicans as well as Democrats. So lots of people do it. And when he was traveling to Michigan last month, he made a huge noise about the fact that they were going to mail out applications for absentee ballots to every voter, to give every voter the shot, not the ballot, but the shot to ask for it. So he has a fit about Michigan, has a fit about Nevada, has a fit about California. But when there were mail votes cast in large numbers for Republican candidates who won congressional elections in Wisconsin and California, he said nothing. He just applauded and pocketed the gains. So the question came up in my mind, what's he really up to? I mean, obviously he wants to play the rules however it suits him, but there's more going on here. If he's selling the idea that you can't trust mail voting, and we're getting more and more mail voting in every state, run by Republicans, Democrats, you name it, Northeast, Southwest, wherever you are, more and more people, because of COVID, it's a natural thing. People want to gravitate in that direction. Well, if he knows that's going on, and the people around him know that's going on, they know they're not going to be able to stop that. They may be able to tighten the rules, a winch here or there, but basically they're not going to stop the trend. And by the way, 30 million people voted by mail in the election that Donald Trump won in 2016. So it's built into our system. Right. So if he's not after that, what is he after? He's after the mistrust of the election. He's after the chance to be able to say in November in any battleground state that's won by Joe Biden, oh, that's corrupt. His words were in his famous tweet of May 20th, I think it was, or the 24th. The United States cannot have all mail-in ballots. I'm reading. It will be the greatest rigged election in history. People grab them from the mailboxes, print thousands of forgeries, force people to sign, forge names. So the whole thing is to be able to claim a rigged election. And then
Donald Trump pulls stuff out of the air, and you know, what is black is white, and then what is white is black. I mean, whatever works for him is convenient. And what he wants to do is make sure that we don't trust the election. And let's be honest, people are still upset about 2016. Hillary got more votes than Donald Trump, but because of the Electoral College, Donald Trump is our president. So we already know people were a little bit disgusted with the results of 2016, but it was also a very close election. And what is so amazing about the 2016 election is that Donald Trump was the most disliked candidate in polling history, followed by Hillary Clinton, who is the second most disliked candidate in American history. I mean, you can't make it up. I mean, right. When I think about that, that's not going to be the case this time. That's not going to be the case this time. Even if Biden worked overtime, you can't dislike him as much as, unfortunately, Hillary was able to be sort of tarnished by a lot of things. That's a lot of it outside our control.
But you can run into a problem here. The question here is all these people who are now out in the Black Lives Matter, you know, George Floyd protests, which are totally appropriate and are really, and they're actually bringing change. I mean, it's a very interesting thing that's going on. It's, something is happening. But are they also going to turn out and vote? That's really critical. Because if they don't, you know, it was 80,000 votes cast another way, you know, in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania last time, and the outcome would have been different. Say, have the same kind of thing that happened in 2016 again this fall with four, five, or six, throw in Arizona, throw in North Carolina, throw in Florida, have six close states where the margin is less than 1%. That's what Donald Trump is doing. He's setting it up so he can say, you can't count those votes, it's illegitimate, and then we're going to hang on and we have a dispute. And what most people don't really remember, if they learned it at all, is the Constitution gives the legislatures of the states the oversight authority over the casting of the electoral votes.
Right.
And in all those critical states that I just mentioned, there, five of them have Democratic governors, but six of them have Republican legislatures. And so if he sows among the public, if he sows, he's not succeeding with Democrats and independents, but you now have 51% of Republicans in the latest polls saying they're opposed to mail voting. And you have those Republican legislatures, he's in a situation where he can maneuver to challenge the vote in those battleground states. And that's a very dangerous situation.
So I we had a huge rally in New Hampshire over the weekend. I think, Ken, it was the largest rally I think we've ever had. 3,000 people showed up in Concord, New Hampshire, okay, to rally about Black Lives Matter, to demand change now, to recognize the life and murder of George Floyd. So I posted a picture, and this is what I posted. I wrote, "They stole his breath. We can't let them steal our vote." And I think what is happening because of this enormous outpouring is that you're concerned about whether they're going to actually connect it to what happens in November. I don't know how you can't connect it. How can you have this outpouring for George Floyd and then not understand that your weapon of choice is the vote? That is what you choose.
It
is more effective than anything Donald Trump can do. He can bring in the military. He can bring in the National Guard. He can build, you know, more walls around the White House. But what you have, he is so jealous of. And that is, you have the right to vote him out.
There's no question. But you did, there were some interviews just the other day among young people in Kenosha, Wisconsin, by reporters who were out covering their George Floyd demonstrations. And they were talking about the demonstration, about Black Lives Matter, about police violence, and they got talking about the election. And in at least four cases out of half a dozen people that were interviewed, and most of them young, they were uncertain whether or not they were against Donald Trump, but they were uncertain whether or not they were gonna vote against Donald Trump, whether or not they were gonna vote for Joe Biden and change the White House. That's a situation that clearly has to change. I mean, if there's a striking victory, if it's a sweep, if the margins are 2-5% and not within 1-2%, then it's going to be much harder to play the game that I was talking about. But you know, if you start to look at the swing states, if you look at the, in the first place, a poll 5 months before an election isn't all that meaningful. Okay, and a national poll in an electoral college country is not that meaningful. So you need to know what it says in Wisconsin and Michigan and Florida and Arizona and North Carolina individually. And there, the margins of Biden's advantage, even in the Fox polls, by the way, are 3 or 4 points. And those are things that can change. And people don't know how, you know, what's the mood going to be 5 months from now if the economy is going up? I mean, look at the stock market. It's crazy. The stock market, you think America was back on track again. You think COVID was done. You would think that there was no problem with violence in the country. Nothing was wrong. So it's hard.
Let me just say something about the stock market. I've been thinking a lot about this. So I'm 66 years old, and I have some underlying health conditions, and I'm obviously worried about possibly getting COVID-19 and could I survive it, okay? So I started writing my obituary, and I started writing letters to my daughters, all right? And So the fact that the market is doing better is good for a lot of old people, because a lot of old people have investments. They have a 401k, they have their pension, but old people want to live. Okay? Because what's the point of having money and having money in the stock market and dying of COVID-19? Yeah. So I hate to break it to you, but Donald Trump's inability to deal with COVID-19, his inability to understand how to protect the nation, his inability to get the right kind of protective equipment, his inability to understand the kind of beds, the fact that so many people over the age of 70 are dying from it, as if old people are expendable. Well, you know, it's really good that old people have money in the market, the market's back. But if you're not alive, who gives a crap?
So, well, I think
that's an important story to tell, because Donald Trump thinks he's got them because look at the market. What he doesn't understand, but if you don't have a chance to live, then what's the point of having the money?
Well, you got it. You got it right there. And actually, these polls do show
that the
vote among the, at least the opinion today among people who are over 65 is much worse against Donald Trump and all those swing states than it was in 2016. I mean, I am. I mean, you're a kid at 66 compared to me, okay? So, I could be babysitting you, right?
Yeah, shush. but understand, I think
people are paying attention to that. They may be better off with their 401k, but they also know if there's a resurgence of COVID-19 in the fall, it's folks like you and me and people in Florida and in Arizona, which are two pivotal states, and in some parts of North Carolina and so on and so forth, where they've got to worry about it. And he has to worry about
that. Could I just add, Hedrick, that not only are old people aware of that, but also the younger people, I suggest, are, at least a lot of them, are very aware of the need to follow up their street uprising with getting out to vote. You know, I was a peacekeeper at the Concord rally and on Saturday, and it was all about Black Lives Matter and police brutality and changing the militarization of police. But, you know, it's also a fact that they said many times, many of the speakers, that we've got to remember to get out there and vote in November and to make sure that something happens, because it's not enough just to turn out and raise our voices. We've actually got to pull the levers. And I also want to say about polling, you know, you're polling this far out certainly is not worth much, but also even the day before the primary elections, the polls showed, you know, Elizabeth Warren doing much better, and then the actual votes were much lower, or Bernie Sanders was way ahead of Biden in the polls, and still he got clobbered in so many primaries after Nevada.
We've been talking about whether young people are going to vote as a result of what happened to George Floyd and the outpouring of people on the streets and the protests. So I guess I have a question I would love to ask the protesters. What do you do to practice hope?
You know, like, I want to talk about the protesters, but for a minute, Arnie, let's also talk about what's going on the part of the people in power. Because what's really striking here is that you've got 8 or 9 states that have decided, Republican governors as well as Democratic, they're going to send out mail-in votes to everybody. You've got another half a dozen states who are going to send out applicants. The point is, there are people on both sides of the aisle in states all across the country that are going to try to make it easy. And that's really important. I mean, yet the question of what the young people are going to do and the protests are going to do is important. We've been talking about that. But what's interesting is the powers that be are trying to encourage the vote. Look what happened this year in the state of Virginia. Unbelievable what happened. There are a bunch of women who took over the leadership of the Virginia legislature. The Democrats won control of it for the first time in 2 decades. And they passed a slew of voting rights bills. Same day voter registration. You can register on election day. Automatic voter registration when you renew your driver's license. No excuse absentee ballot. You can get it for any reason whatsoever. They got rid of the photo ID law that Virginia had. Down there in Florida, they're having a fight to restore the voting rights of 1.4 million former felons who want to be returning citizens. They want jobs. They want to vote. They want to return to society. They want to be a respectable part of it. 1.4 million. The elections in Florida sometimes are won by 40, 50, 60,000 votes. So, exactly. So they, I mean, we had it, in 2016, we had 41 million Americans who were eligible to vote in terms of age, in terms of residence. They qualified and they didn't vote. I mean, the numbers are huge. So the opportunity out there to draw more people into American democracy is enormous. And in 2018, there were half a dozen states that did, you know, what Virginia did this year. So there's a movement that's going on despite what the president's saying. And we are focused on it. We need to pay attention to it. He can play games and people are worried about that. But the trend among people in both parties who are in office is to actually make voting easier. And that's positive. People need to take advantage. People need to know about it and take advantage of it.
Well, but I think the story that came out of Florida, when Florida by referendum restored the right to vote for ex-felons, and it was overwhelming. It was a really amazing vote.
Over 60%.
So you know what that says to me? People understand the value of the vote. They understand that it's precious. They wanted to make sure that if we are coming back into society, part of being part of society is to be able to exercise the franchise. It's part of the fabric of a community. It's the Velcro that holds us together. And here were Floridians that were saying, you know what? As you point out, 60% of them said, absolutely. You need to be under one arm and under the other arm, and we're going to go vote together. That is a remarkable statement about the democratic institutions that we want to be healthy, that we believe in, that we understand. That's what gives us the ability to make change.
But even after that election, though, the powers that be made it not happen by manipulating whatever they manipulated behind the scenes.
What they did was they said that the felons had to pay the fines and the bank fees and the court fees, but then there's been a lawsuit filed and a federal judge has ruled that that's unconstitutional. In fact, there's a constitutional amendment that says you can't impose a poll tax, because that's what the South used to do to keep blacks from voting. And they said, this is just a modern poll tax. Now the challenge is to actually do it. My point was that even before the horrible murder of George Floyd, even before that, even before COVID, the powers that be in lots of states were moving in the direction of making voting easier. There was a sense that fairness and a level playing field and a more open and inclusive democracy was something that people wanted. Now, this isn't everywhere. And there's no question. I mean, was it Frederick Douglass said, power never surrenders without a fight, without a command. And there's absolutely no question. Frederick Douglass was right on back then, and he's right on today. I mean, the people who have power and who see their only way of protecting their power is limiting the power of others and stacking the deck and rigging the elections, they're going to keep right on doing that. So it's a fight. This is a wonderful comment made by this woman, Linda Bach, that I covered out in Seattle. She said, democracy, you have to fight for it. Otherwise, it'll slip right through your hands. I mean, we're not engaged in a spectator sport here. We're engaged in, this is an activist for it. This is not robots. This is not autopilot.
Democracy. Right, but my point was the Frederick Douglass point, that basically you have to continue to fight. You have to be ever vigilant. It's not over after the marches yesterday. It's not over after the election in November. You got to just keep on fighting that it doesn't slip away or get stolen away day of the rest of your life.
Amen to that, Ken. And a lot of people didn't properly understand that. A lot of people, whether it's environmental laws or whatever laws that get passed, people said, oh, well, we've done it. We did our bit. We demonstrated and they'll take care of it. They won't. You got to make sure they do.
So I was at a public library in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and John Nichols of The Nation magazine had come to speak, and the room was packed. Okay. And he said to us at the very beginning of his speech, he goes, I want you all to stand up. And then he said, I want everyone of color to sit down. Of course, this is New Hampshire. There maybe was a half dozen. Then he says, I want all the women to sit down. And then he said, I want all the renters to sit down. And he goes to this whole laundry list of, you know, people that needed to sit down, and everyone over a certain age and everyone who didn't own property.
Right.
And by the time he got done, there was like, you know, 14 old white-haired men. Unfortunately, they look like you.
That's who wrote the
Constitution. And they're all standing. And that's it. He goes, I want to welcome you to 1776. And the only people that could exercise the franchise. And then he reminded everyone that the story of America was the story of constantly expanding the franchise, of bringing more and more people in. And then he reminded everyone to stand up. and say, this is who we are, but this is how we started. And the idea isn't to go back and to contract. The idea is to constantly understand the fight to expand. And it's been a fight every single time. But it was so powerful to see it visually, Hendrik. I mean, people were crying because it was just, it was like, it made you realize how precious it was. And it made you realize your obligation to participate, because it started with a group of, you know, white men. And now look at the diversity in this room, and all of us get to participate. But it didn't happen because they said, oh, you should come too. We had to fight for it.
Well, that's why I call it the Democracy Rebellion. If you'll forgive me, I've actually done a film on that, which is called the Democracy Rebellion. It's up on YouTube. People can see it. But that's exactly the point. I mean, Barack Obama made that point all the time. Remember, he kept saying, they said in order to form a more perfect union, that's exactly what he meant. What he meant was the starting place wasn't great. You got to keep expanding it. You got to keep working on it. And there's no question. I mean, what Ken said before is true. What Frederick Douglass said is right. The people who have the power jealously guard it and protect it. And you got to say, hey, we belong too. And the great thing, and we may be on the verge of this period again in our history. I mean, if you look back at the progressive era, I mean, it's just about a century ago, a little bit more than a century ago, that women got the right to vote, that we had direct election of senators instead of having them handpicked by legislatures to make sure they protected the railroad and the oil interests, right? So, I mean, that's not all that long ago. In 1907, they passed an act, the Tillman Act, that banned corporate money in campaigns. So this is an issue we've come back to again and again and again. And they won it, and it lasted for quite a while, and then along comes the civil rights movement of the 60s, and it's another progressive burst to expand, to widen the circle of American democracy, and we're going through it right now. I mean, I actually find it encouraging. I find it hopeful that so many people want to be involved, and I think if had it not been for COVID, I think there would be a lot more people on the streets today. I mean, you look at the numbers of people on the streets, and I can tell you, I and my friends would like to be there, but we're of an age where it's really risky to do that. You know, we can't do it. But there is a lot of sentiment that goes way beyond the crowds that are out on the streets, and God bless them for being there, to say we've got to change this thing. I mean, I have to say, you were talking in the last segment about defunding the police department. It isn't about defunding. No. It's about reexamining how we take care of public safety so it genuinely protects people instead of intimidating people, instead of frightening people. And it may well be that you have to actually defund the current police department, form another one, and either rehire or not rehire the cops who want to play by a new set of rules that are more decent, and have civilian oversight boards, maybe with every precinct, maybe not just with the city police, but with every precinct, and a whole lot of other rules that are different
and you have to solve problems. And when you stop solving problems, when you realize how many kids go hungry and go to school, when you realize how many kids go home to empty houses, you know, what the after school programs, they weren't a joke. You know, my brother went to prep school and I went to public school. Let me tell you something about prep school compared to public school. My brother left at 7 o'clock in the morning and got home at 6 o'clock at night. What did he do? He had school during the day. Then after school, still at the prep school, he had sports, he had additional work in his Latin, he had this, he had that, and then he came home at around 6 o'clock.
How come you got so smart?
But what I want people to know is that was the private after school program. They knew that they weren't done at 2 o'clock. They continued to invest in him for the next 2 or 3 hours, whether it was theater or sports or extracurricular activity, whatever it was. Well, if that's good for the privileged, then guess what? It probably is good for every kid. So if you want cops to do what they really are intended to do, make sure the kids are being educated and fed and have after school programs, because you know what? You will have fewer gangs if kids are actually, you know, learning how to play chess. So I look at my brother's experience and I said, that needs to be the experience of every child. And if we could invest in that, then guess what? It's not about defunding the police. They will have less to do. And that's my goal.
And we've also dumped things on the police that they shouldn't be doing. I mean, they're taking care of a whole lot of mental health.
Exactly.
They shouldn't be doing, and they probably don't want to be doing. I mean, so if we had better social services, we could be doing that. It seems to me that if you got the Minneapolis City Council and the Denver City Council and the LA City Council and the Providence City Council and these other city councils starting to go back and to the drawing board and looking at how they're spending their money, how they're allocating, and back to our issue of voting and wondering and worrying how people are going to vote and how they're going to be judged as to whether or not they're actually responding to the demonstrations that are going on now in a positive way for the long-term social, economic, emotional, and literal health of their communities, then it seems to me we're engaged in exactly what we should be engaged in. I mean, you were talking earlier with somebody else on the earlier segment of the show. Public engagement is enormously important. If this process is drawing a new generation of people into civic engagement, it isn't just demonstrations, but at least a certain percentage of these young people carry on and carry on with this in other parts of their lives and for the rest of their lives, even as they have kids and as they grow older, it will be wonderful for our democracy long term.
I need to let Hendrik Smith go. He is the executive editor of ReclaimTheAmericanDream.org, so you need to check it out. He has been working on issues like this forever, and actually he's been so aware of the politics and the policy and the facts that matter that actually sort of create the destiny that we live in. Hendrik Smith, thank you so much for joining us. You are the way I practice hope. I check in with Hendrik Smith.
I just love mixing it up with you, Arnie.
All right, ciao. All right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. We'll chat tomorrow.
You, who are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh. Of tender years, can't know the fears that you held as good eyes, and so please help them with your youth. They see the truth before they can die. Teach your parents well, their children's hell will slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by. Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry, so just look at them and sigh.